Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. The use of vaping devices has seemingly exploded in the past few years, especially with the advent of the Juul e-cigarette in 2017. There are numerous makes and models from different manufacturers in varying shapes, sizes, and colors, along with an array of vaping liquids. But since the beginning, there have been questions about the safety of inhaling vapors from fluids which might contain ingredients such as nicotine, heavy metals, or cannabis compounds, and about the marketing of vaping devices, which seems to target young people. Now there's news that hundreds of people, mostly young adults, have been hospitalized with severe lung disease linked to vaping, some with tragic consequence. Six have died. So this hour, we'll get the latest on the controversy surrounding e-cigarettes and vaping devices. And we'd like you to weigh in as well. Do you vape or know someone who does? And what is your reaction to the latest news about vaping? Here's the number, 888-477-9499. You can send an email to radiotimes at whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joining us to get started is Lena Sun, a health reporter who's been covering this story for The Washington Post. Good to have you with us, Lena.
Nice to be here.
So this summer, we have seen literally hundreds of mysterious lung ailments across the country. And health officials say they believe, Lena, these cases are tied to vaping.
Yes, that is the one thing that they know. There are a lot of things they don't know, but the one thing that they do know is that every person who has gotten sick has used some kind of device to vape aerosol, and that turns into clouds, and people have inhaled it. They don't know whether it's from nicotine products or from marijuana products, specifically THC, which is the ingredient that, you know, gives you the high. So far, the evidence seems to strongly suggest that it is something in the THC products, especially in THC products that may have been contaminated or adulterated or, as the jargon goes in the industry, cut with thickening agents.
And there's word this morning that a sixth person has died. Do we know the circumstances yet?
That was yesterday that the sixth person died, and they have not given out a lot of information. This was a Kansas resident who was older, and so far, of the six people that are known to have died, four have been described as either middle-aged or older. And in two cases, officials have specified what it was they were vaping, and they have said it was a marijuana product. We don't know the ages of the other adults, and we don't have the information on what other products they were vaping.
What sorts of symptoms are we talking about, Lena, when people fall ill?
Shortness of breath, chest pain, difficulty breathing, and sometimes there's also gastro issues, diarrhea, vomiting, nausea. And if you think about it, when you get those symptoms, those are very common symptoms. They could be caused by multitude of illnesses. And when you go to the urgent care clinic, doctors typically think about the more common ailments, some kind of flu or viral illness, and tend to, you know, tell you go home and rest. And what's happened in a lot of these cases is these people have gotten sick and they've gone home and they've just gotten worse. And then they become very sick and they present to the emergency room. And there they have to scramble to figure out, first they have to rule out that it's not a viral infection or a bacterial infection. And by the time you rule out all the infectious agents, this is something that health officials want doctors to think about. Consider this as a possibility, especially if that person has a history of vaping.
Some clinicians, Lena, are saying they found abnormal immune cells in the lungs of some of these patients. What does that mean? What do they know?
So when you think about when you're vaping, you are heating up a liquid and it turns into gas. And the theory is that if you are using a product that is not supposed to be in there, when that gas turns into a cloud and then you inhale it, when that gas cools down, it returns to its original state at that pressure and temperature, and that could turn into oil droplets or that get into your lungs. Your lungs are not supposed to have anything in them except, you know, oxygen and CO2. That's their job. They can't expel oil droplets. And so when those oil droplets get in, the immune cells go to work and they try to break them down, but they can't break them down. And those immune cells get bigger and bigger. They sort of bloat and they cause this buildup of tissue in your lungs. And then your lungs cannot do the job to get oxygen into your bloodstream. So you can't breathe.
There has been a particular focus on something called vitamin E acetate. What is this?
Vitamin E acetate is an oil that is derived from vitamin E. And people think, oh, it's a vitamin. Harmless. You know, it's found in foods. It's often used as a nutritional supplement, and it's in cosmetics. The difference is when you eat something or you put it on your skin, it is a different way of affecting your body than when you inhale it. So vitamin E acetate has a very high boiling point, about 360 degrees Fahrenheit, which is higher than the boiling point of water. So when that gets heated up to that really high temperature to turn that nice big vape cloud that people like, and then you inhale it, then when it cools down in your lungs, it turns into oil or lipid, and that is what gets into your lungs and causes that immune reaction that I was just describing. Sort of think of like when you take a shower, there's a big steam. The steam comes out and condenses on the mirror. That condenses as liquid.
What is the FDA saying about vitamin E acetate and these lung illnesses? And again, there have been hundreds of them.
Right. So the if you're piecing together this puzzle, the vitamin E acetate is the first common element that investigators have found in samples that they have taken from people who got sick in New York State and in samples that they have collected from people across the country that the FDA lab is testing. The FDA lab is testing samples from all the states. New York has a really good lab. It is testing samples taken from New York residents. So the fact that vitamin E acetate was found as a common element is a potential clue. And New York State has taken the next step and issued subpoenas to three companies whose products are thickening agents. These are things that are used to dilute THC oil. THC oil is very thick and it's odorless and it's clear. But if you want to make money and you dilute it with something else, then you double your profit. So these thickening agents have come on the market, and when they found evidence of these vitamin E acetate in thickening agents made by these companies, they have issued subpoenas to these three companies.
Lena Sun, have the Centers for Disease Control weighed in on this?
They have. They're leading the investigation. So the CDC and the FDA are doing this together. CDC is the investigative lead. FDA is doing the sort of technical analysis, testing for the products. The CDC is approaching this as a, you know, as an investigation. You have to get everybody who is sick, take all the stuff that they were using. They use different devices, different products, different brands, try to look for the commonalities, try to figure out what made them sick, and narrow it down from there. And they have both said that in the meantime, until they figure out what is causing people to get sick, they're urging consumers not to vape. And especially not to vape anything that you have bought on the street or for whose contents you don't know. I mean, there are many young people who do use make their own vape juice, do-it-yourself home brews. Not a good idea.
Yeah. It seems as if it is a long and complicated investigative process involving many, many cases. I don't know if you have this information at your fingertips, but is there any indication as to when there might be some sort of conclusion coming from the CDC?
No. Right now, they have 450 possible cases in 33 states. And the tricky part of this is, unlike an infectious disease outbreak where you know what the culprit is, like this particular virus or this particular bacteria, they don't know really what they're looking for, right? It could be and so they are also trying to collect the information from the states, and they have not. They don't really have a system of collecting this kind of information that's not infectious, so they had to set up a system to collect the data. And then on top of that, you have the fact that marijuana is illegal under federal law, but many states have legalized it. So there's that regulatory issue, which makes it difficult to get cooperation, especially from young people. If you are a young person and somebody asks you what you have been vaping and you're in a state where marijuana is not legal, you are not going to maybe immediately be forthcoming, especially if your parents are in the room and say, oh, yeah, I was vaping THC.
So aside from these issues, the issue regarding the lung cases, you know, e-cigarettes are marketed as generally, Lena, being less harmful than conventional cigarettes. But as you write, e-cigarette aerosol is not harmless, regardless of this investigation, because of what it contains. Not necessarily
harmless.
Right.
It's not necessarily harmless. And, you know, there hasn't been a lot of research done on what happens when you inhale flavorings. I'm not even talking about the vitamin E acetate, right? That's an oil. And when it gets heated up, we don't know what happens in the lungs. You can eat it. And it's been shown to be okay if you eat it or if you put it on your skin. If you get some rash on your skin, you can wash it off. You can't do that once it gets into your lungs. And also, the whole process of heating something up creates different byproducts, different chemicals. And we don't know what happens in that, quote unquote, thermal degradation, right? There hasn't been any research, or there has been very little research.
I've read that some of these products can contain ultrafine particles, heavy metals, volatile organic compounds, and other questionable ingredients.
Yes. And, you know, people don't know what that does to your lungs. The broader debate, and I'm sure your other guests may get into this, is like, well, e-cigarettes, you know, it's much less harmful than smoking a conventional cigarette, you know, by comparison. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have bad effects for your health. And especially until we know what is really going on with this investigation, it wouldn't be bad to be cautious.
Lena Sun, do you know at this point if the industry is pushing back?
Which industry? We're talking about two different industries.
Okay, the e-cigarette industry. I should be more specific.
Yeah, they are pushing back, and they are very heavily pointing out every time that somebody is sickened or hospitalized or dies and says it's because of a link to a illicit marijuana product. They're saying, you see, it's all the marijuana stuff. It's not the e-cigarettes. Yeah. And like I said earlier, the evidence does suggest it's really something contaminating that manufacturing process or an adulterant in the marijuana products, because there's so much stuff on the black market. You can buy so much stuff online, and there's so much counterfeiting that you, the consumer, don't know what's in there. And these marijuana products are expensive if you buy it in a regular dispensary. And you go buy it on the street, it's much cheaper, and people do that, and then you don't know what's in the ingredients at all.
Lena Sun, thank you so much for joining us to start us off.
You're welcome.
Lena Sun is national reporter for The Washington Post. She covers health, and we will have more on this issue in just a moment here on WHYY Radio Times. We'll talk about the rising popularity of vaping among teens, the health risks, again, that e-cigarettes pose, the rates of usage, the cultural forces that entice young people to experiment with vaping products. Frank Leone is director of comprehensive smoking treatment programs at the University of Pennsylvania. We'll also hear from Suchitra Krishnan-Sarin, professor of psychiatry at Yale. And again, we'd like to hear from you, 888-477-9499. This is Radio Times. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Muskawayne has the day off today. We are spending the hour taking a close look at vaping. Hundreds of people across the country have been hospitalized with severe lung illness in recent months. And at last word, six have died. Health officials believe the lung disease in question is likely linked to vaping. Vaping devices and e-cigarettes have become enormously popular with teens and young adults. And indeed, a great many of those who have fallen ill are young. For the remainder of the hour, we'll be talking about the appeal of vaping, the cultural forces that entice people to experiment with vaping products, and of course, the health risks that can be posed by e-cigarettes. If you vape, If you know someone who vapes or if you'd just like to join the conversation, we'd like to hear what you think. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Frank Leone is Director of Comprehensive Smoking Treatment Programs at the University of Pennsylvania and also Professor of Medicine at the hospital at Penn. Welcome back to Radio Times, Frank.
Hi, Mary. Thanks so much for having me.
And Suchitra Krishnansaran is a professor of psychiatry at Yale, specializing in adolescent tobacco use. Good to have you with us, Suchitra.
Thank you for having me.
So hundreds of cases of severe lung disease and now a half dozen deaths in recent months. Frank Leone, first to you, what is your reaction to what seems to be a growing crisis?
I mean, just as a father and a human, it's a shame because this didn't really have to happen. We could have spent a little time up front sort of analyzing these products, trying to understand how they were built, what kinds of constituents were in the aerosol, the physical properties of the aerosol, and what the impact was likely to be on the lung at the very beginning of this phenomenon, and giving people the information they needed in order to make reasonable decisions about what they did in their behaviors. Instead, these products entered the market, overtook the market, were positioned as potentially safer than cigarettes on a, you know, wishful thinking, really. Yeah. And now this is the situation that we're dealing with.
Suchitra, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, these products, I'd start out by saying that if they are shown, and a lot of evidence shows they do help smokers quit smoking, if they are indeed helpful to smokers to quit smoking, they should be regulated and available in a way that they are available to smokers, but not necessarily to all the youth who are initiating use of this product without even having smoked in the first place. So this is definitely concerning. We need better regulations around these products.
We're going to get into marketing and regulation in just a few moments, but we've got a lot of calls and comments coming in, so let's get to them right off the bat. Alex in Philadelphia, welcome to Radio Times. Hi, Alex.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question or comment? We're fine, thanks.
Yeah, you know, I was a longtime smoker, over 15 years, cigarettes, that is. And I actually turned to vaporizers to try to get me off of, you know, off of the regular cigarettes because I had those triggers. You know, I smelled smoke, or if I walked by somebody smoking outside, I'd bum a smoke. So I didn't, you know, quit smoking. I quit buying a lot of times, and it got me back on. So vaporizers actually did help me get rid of those cigarette-related triggers. Unfortunately, you know, vaporizers, one of the things they don't really tell you is that you do it everywhere, so you do so much of it.
And there was nicotine in your vaporizers, assuming, since you were trying to?
Yeah, it was over-the-counter, like Vuse, Vibe-type, you know, the standard cartridges, not like online or anything, but it basically, I probably smoked or vaped twice as much as I did smoking because you'd have to go outside for a cigarette where a vaporizer, I would just sit in my office and hop on it all day.
Were you in a smoking treatment program at the time or were you just able to buy these devices and try to get off of the nicotine yourself?
I just tried to do it myself. I'd been through multiple smoking cessation classes, the patch, Wellbutrin, Chantix, the lozenge, the gum. I tried everything prior.
All right. Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Alex. So these devices, you had smoking cessation programs over at Penn,
yeah.
Frank. Are they prescribed as an aid to get off?
They're not.
Traditional cigarettes, or this is something that is Alex, you just kind of go up and eat?
Yeah, I really do feel a little bit like this is a position that the healthcare system sort of abdicated to popular opinion. Unfortunately, you know, nicotine dependence is actually a very powerful problem. Nicotine creates dependence. It's very addictive. It's more addictive than heroin. People, just like Alex, struggle for years trying to figure out ways to get off of cigarettes. And I don't really feel like we do a great job helping people understand what the truth is behind sort of managing this dependence syndrome. And so it's not uncommon for people to sort of feel a bit of desperation and go out and find ways themselves to come off of the cigarettes. And I'm very happy for Alex that he was able to come off the cigarettes, but I don't know that the assumption that switching from cigarettes to an electronic aerosol device is actually healthier.
Is there more nicotine sometimes in these devices than in conventional cigarettes?
There's frequently more nicotine in those devices. As Alex mentioned, people use them very differently. There's the sort of ability to just use them over the course of the day and increase exposure to the toxicants in the aerosol is actually much higher. And what we know is there's a very significant portion of people like Alex who try to come off of cigarettes but actually end up in this sort of middle phase where they're using vaporizers some part of the day and regular cigarettes another part of the day. And those people actually end up with a higher proportion of respiratory and cardiovascular symptoms than if they had just smoked cigarettes alone.
Suchitra Krishnan-Sarin, we mentioned earlier the increasing use of vaping devices by teens and young adults. Okay, we'll get her back in just a moment. I think we lost her phone line. So, Frank, I'll throw this question to you.
Sure.
What is the appeal culturally of vaping devices to the young?
So when you think about appeal of these devices, you really have to separate in your head what's going on in the adult sort of incumbent smoker versus what's going on with young people. With young folks, it's very much of a kind of a cultural phenomenon. It's about being included. It's about being part of something that's a little risky.
And these devices are marketed to be kind of fun.
Oh, absolutely.
Flavors and sizes and shapes and colors.
Absolutely. Thousands of flavor brands are out there and available. The majority of them are flavors that you would imagine would appeal to young people, fruity flavors, et cetera, sweet flavors. And the newest generation of devices, the ones that look a lot like USB drives, are actually designed for a couple of things. First of all, the type of nicotine, the specific salt of nicotine that has been engineered to be in those devices is both flavorless, so it doesn't create the burning sensation in the back of the throat, and easy to dissociate from the salt into the free base form. And in the free base form of nicotine, nicotine is very highly addictive. And so you have products that are designed to be cool, to be sort of smartphone-oriented, technically oriented, attractive to young people by virtue of the flavors, and boom, hit them with a very highly addictive form of nicotine in high concentrations.
Suchitra, let me just bring her back into the conversation because we do have you back. How might nicotine affect brain development?
So nicotine is, there's a lot of literature on this suggesting that nicotine is a neurotoxin, especially in the adolescent brain. And that there are, most of this comes from preclinical work because, you know, it would not be ethical to really bring a human adolescent into a lab and give them nicotine and see what happens. So a lot of what we know about what nicotine does comes from animal studies. And the animal studies suggest that in the adolescent animal, nicotine definitely is a neurotoxin that changes a lot of the neural systems which are involved in cognition, you know, things like attention, memory processes. And that use of nicotine in these young animals also changes the brain in a way that it makes them more prone to use other substances like, you know, cocaine, marijuana, alcohol in the long run. So there are definite changes that take place in the adolescent brain following nicotine exposure. The other thing we worry about with nicotine exposure, both in the prenatal and the adolescent period, are epigenetic changes. So changes that actually are produced in your genes, which change how you and your future generations respond to certain things. So, for example, one of the changes which has been shown in the animal work is changes in genes related to asthma, changes in some of the genes related to depression. So, you know, there could be changes being produced because you're being exposed to nicotine at this very sensitive young age.
And so if we're talking about genetic changes, then they are permanent.
Yes, they are.
Possibly.
And that is the concern about, you know, any initiation of use of nicotine-containing products amongst youth.
Frank, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is such an interesting area, this area of epigenetics where we're starting to understand the interaction between the genes that we inherit and the exposures to environmental toxicants that are just a part of life is really interesting. And Suchitra's example of asthma was one of the first examples that really knocked me off my chair. If a woman uses tobacco and exposed to nicotine through tobacco, the changes in asthma gene expression can be seen two generations downfield. Mm-hmm. So it's really a remarkable phenomenon.
And again, nicotine is highly addictive. Let's go to Mary in Wilmington, Delaware, a caller who has a comment or a question related to this part of the discussion. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a college-age son. I was with him and his girlfriend yesterday. My son has some asthma. He's been using a vape pen for at least 3 years. And I asked them how many of their friends use these things, and they said like 95% of them. So there's a real cultural aspect among our young people that I think a lot of adults are blind to. And as a parent, I'm kind of outraged because I don't know with the marketing, how well have these claims been established with the manufacturers? And have I kind of feel like they've unleashed a bigger beast than we had with the tobacco companies. So I'll take your comments offline.
Sure. Thanks, Mary, for the call to Radio Times. Where has the federal government been in all of this? Frank?
So I want to start by saying that I believe the folks at the FDA sort of have a good heart. They're good-hearted about this. They're really trying hard to put their arms around a difficult phenomenon.
Because the question is, these things went on the market, I mean, without complete FDA approval.
Yeah,
the process is complicated, and the approval is still being worked on for many devices,
right,
if I'm understanding this correctly, but they're still out there being sold.
Very early on when these products were introduced to the United States market, the FDA sued for these products not to be sold. Manufacturers of these products not sued. They tried to get them not sold. The manufacturers of the products sued the FDA to say these are neither drug delivery devices nor medical devices. It went all the way up to the federal appeals court, and the FDA lost. And so now it created a in-between position for these devices where they weren't drugs and they weren't subject to the typical regulatory pathways. So the FDA had to actually get legislation approved over time to give them some level of regulatory authority, and now they're in the phase of trying to execute on that regulatory authority. It's been a long time coming. I feel like the bureaucracy has led to a lot of foot dragging and contemplating. While their hearts are in the right place, I don't think there has been the kind of urgency that Mary is feeling right now, justifiably so.
Yeah. So, Chitra, with a parent like Mary who's concerned about her son's vaping, you know, when it comes to young people and anything that they might be doing that is questionable to a parent, telling them what to do and perhaps seeming judgmental about it, even if it's not intentional, might not work and even backfire. How do parents tackle this?
That's a very good question. Well, it depends on the age of the child. Obviously, if you have a youth who's older, it's always hard to have these conversations with your children, no matter actually what age they are. But I think having the conversation and continuing to have the conversation with them, sending them information about these instances where, you know, people are finding these instances of vaping deaths, constantly educating them and educating yourself is a very important piece of this. One of the things that we do a lot in Connecticut here is actually go out and speak to a lot of parents, speak to a lot of kids and school educators about these products and why it is not safe for young people to start using them. But we are really fighting a cultural phenomenon because for many years we told these youths not to start using cigarettes, and we put a lot of things into place, education and regulation-wise, to prevent them from using cigarettes. And so now they consider cigarettes to be nasty, something that they will not use, but they consider these products to be clean and green and think they are safe to use. And I think these instances we are seeing, the vaping deaths, is really raising the concerns that I and many other people like me in the field have been saying for a long time, that we don't know enough about these products, and it is not okay to just allow people who have never used cigarettes to just start using these products and tell them that it's okay to use.
Mm. Last year, and Frank Leone, I'll address this to you, Juul committed to stop marketing its products to young people on social media, terminating its Instagram and Facebook accounts. You've seen an increase, I understand, in your practice of young people. How much of an effect do you think Juul's actions might have had in curbing any underage use of its products, or is the horse out of the barn, long gone?
Yeah, unfortunately, I feel like it's yesterday's news. It's great that they committed to stopping. It's great that their public face forward is to help adults stop smoking. But the truth is there's hundreds of internet Instagram influencers out there. There are hundreds of counterfeit pod manufacturers putting all kinds of things in these pods that these kids are using. And there are sort of cultural events that have sprouted up organically that promote the use of these products, vape cloud competitions, et cetera, like trading pods back and forth. The types of activities that are social and bring young people together with common cause. So I feel like a warning letter from the FDA to Juul to stop talking about the safety effects of their product is just not enough. I think there really has to be a much more aggressive clampdown.
So, Chitra, what do parents need to be on the lookout for, signs that their teens might be vaping or worse, dealing with a potential addiction?
Just be more vigilant. See what your children are doing. The problem with these vape products is that they don't generate smoke the same way that cigarettes do, right? So that is one of the issues, that they are, you can hide them easily from your parents, from your teachers. So being aware of what your teen or youth is doing, and watching their behaviors, and also if you think they are using these products, having a conversation with them. And if they actually come out and tell you that I'm addicted and I cannot quit, then reaching out to physicians like Dr. Leone to get help to help them quit using these products would be what I would do.
And if they don't come right out and say, I have a problem, and as a parent you think there's a problem, at what point do you push treatment?
Well, I think that depends. It varies from individual to individual. I think the best way to convince a child is by showing them all the literature about how these products can have an immediate effect on your health. You know, a lot of times kids really think that this is something I'm going to use now, and then I'll be able to quit when I want, and it's not going to influence my health in any way. But I would be willing to bet that all this data we are seeing on asthma, increasing asthma-related issues, these vaping deaths, are going to be a good way to start the conversation.
So, Chitra, unfortunately, I know we have to let you go. We're up against the clock. I'm so sorry, but thank you so much for joining us. Chitra Krishnansaran, professor of psychiatry at Yale. Stay with us for more of Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In this hour, we've been talking about vaping, the fact that hundreds of people across the country have been hospitalized with severe lung illness. As of Monday, there is word of 6 deaths. Many of the people who have fallen ill are young. Vaping devices are marketed toward the young. And as we went into the break with Suchitra Krishnansaran, Frank Leone, we were talking about signs that parents who think their children might have a problem with addiction, you know, at what point do you shepherd these young people toward treatment? And you were talking off mic about one of them.
Yeah, so Suchitra actually mentioned that these products actually can be hidden. So that's actually been promoted as the idea is called stealth or zero vaping. So you could use these products in places where you're not supposed to, in class, at work, on a plane, etc. And you do that by inhaling the aerosol, then holding your breath for several seconds and kind of just sort of pushing down just a little bit. And the aerosol dissipates into the lung and none of it comes out. You can't do that with a cigarette. But the key to that idea is that if you are in a position to use the device despite the risk of getting into massive trouble, that should be considered a sign of dependence. That's a dependence sign. And so parents who sort of notice that kind of behavior, even if the child says, I don't want to quit, I don't need it, I'll do it when I'm ready, those sorts of things, you need to talk to a healthcare professional about the possibility of dependence and ways to treat the syndrome before the patient is actually ready to give them up.
And again, Frank, you are Director of Comprehensive Smoking Treatment Programs at Penn. You're also a pulmonologist. In your practice, have the professionals who work with you, have you talked to these young folks that you're seeing about some of the illnesses that have been discovered across the country? And if so, what are they, what's the reaction from the teens and young adults?
Yeah, so it's kind of mixed, as you would expect. The kids sort of follow the same pattern that adults would. Many of them are very concerned and don't want this to happen to them and will try and put their their e-cigarette device down. Some of them take the opposite approach and say, you know what, this is it's all about the THC or it's all about the vitamin E. That's not going to happen to me. The truth is that we don't know what it's about. And everybody who's using an electronic cigarette device at this point is at least at risk for having this happen. So we talk about it, but I don't really expect it necessarily to be a sufficient motivator to necessarily change behavior. That requires treating the underlying dependence, the underlying addictive properties of nicotine.
All right. Back to the phones we go. Muhammad in Exton, welcome to Radio Times.
Yes. Hi. I have a question. I'm an ex-smoker. And I had tried various methods like nicotine patch, nicotine gum with health coaches. None of them worked. And since I started vaping a couple months ago, I was able to stay off of cigarettes. So my question is, with all these new concerns that surface with vaping, what is the recourse for me? Should I go back to traditional cigarettes or stay with vaping?
So you're not quite off the nicotine yet then?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Thanks. Hang on for a moment, Muhammad. Frank?
Yeah. So Muhammad's situation is so common. Muhammad, don't go back to regular cigarettes, but actually talk to your healthcare provider, somebody who has an interest in this area, and talk about the ways that you've used those products in the past, and perhaps if there's more reasonable evidence-based ways, approaches to use these products in combination or for longer periods of time in order to try and help you come off the vaping products over time. I don't feel like it's such an emergency where you need to come off the vape product today, but you need to have it in mind and actually come up with a plan with in conjunction with somebody who knows how to help you.
All right, Muhammad, thank you so much and best of luck to you. So, Frank, it sounds as if there is a reason to keep e-cigarettes on the market because they are, if somebody is trying to quit smoking, get off nicotine, they might be a better approach than sticking with conventional cigarettes.
Yeah. There might be a reason under the assumption that e-cigarettes are safer than cigarettes.
Yeah.
But you know what? I'll point out that if we were in the cigarette epidemic 100 years ago, 15 years after the introduction of cigarettes onto the market, we would have absolutely no idea that those products were bad for us. There would be nobody who's suffering from respiratory failure. There'd be nobody who's suffering from lung cancer. There would be nobody who developed emphysema yet. And so on a sort of minute-to-minute basis, if you compare apples to apples, it actually turns out that cigarettes might even be, I hate to say it this way because it doesn't make sense, but e-cigarettes may be less safe.
Yeah.
And the definitions of harm are variable, right? So the harms of electronic cigarettes don't have to be the same as the harms of cigarettes. So if e-cigarettes might prevent a lung cancer, that's great. But if they cause, say, low oxygen levels and the requirement for 24-hour oxygen in a young person,
or changes in brain development.
Changes in brain development. Have we done it? Have we actually prevented harm? We've prevented some harms, but substituted others.
And the fact is the research on vaping devices just isn't there yet.
That's right. Exactly right.
All right. We've got a Facebook comment from Drew. These are bootleg THC cartridges causing the problem, and he is referring to the lung illnesses that are being examined, the hundreds across the nation. Every article I have read, the headline is vaping causes this or that. When you read the article, it says the patient admitted to vaping THC. We don't know that for certain yet, but that is part of what is being investigated, these thickening substances with the possible addition of, vitamin E, acetate,
right.
You know, could be at issue here, but that hasn't been confirmed.
Yeah, that's true. So it is true that THC has been, at least that the users have believed that there's been THC in the majority of products, but not all of them. It is in some case series from North Carolina and from New York. The presentation of illness has been very consistent with what the doctors call lipoid pneumonia, which is the sort of downstream consequence of inhaling oils. In other case series, they don't look like lipoid pneumonia. So my contention is that it's too early to pin it on any specific constituent. There's probably some important constituents that we need to know about, but it's most likely to be an interaction between the way people use it, how deeply they inhale, how much of an aerosol they inhale, how long they hold it, how they modify it, what they put in it and what they don't put in it, and the ability of the device itself to heat it up and create a variety of different particle sizes. Those other aspects can't be ignored when it comes to the lung. The lung is sensitive to all of those issues, not just which constituent is in the soup.
As a pulmonologist, can you give us some sense of what these patients who have are being treated with these lung illnesses, what they are experiencing physically when they are hospitalized?
All right, so generally what people will report are very general, vague symptoms, maybe a cough or a sense of wheeze, a sense of shortness of breath, particularly with exercise, going up the steps or something along those lines. And it kind of comes and goes a little bit. So there's a periodicity or variability in those symptoms. So, you know, everybody kind of shrugs those off. I'm going to get over this. I'll get better. But over time, there's an accumulation and the symptoms get worse and they finally present to some kind of medical facility. And if a chest X-ray or an blood oxygen level gets determined, you know, then you see there's a chest X-ray abnormality that looks like pneumonia. Oxygen.
What does that feel like? That's what I'm trying to get to. When somebody's in the ICU,
yeah,
and you're being treated for this, what are they experiencing?
Oh, in the ICU, it's a whole nother ball game. You imagine running a marathon and feeling terribly short of breath and not able to catch your breath, and imagine not being able to catch your breath ever, like for no matter what you do. And so then all of a sudden the doctors kind of get involved and put you on a ventilator and take over the work of breathing and have to sedate you and sometimes put you in a coma, and it's really a mess. Eventually we end up, in the worst cases, we find ourselves supporting the function of lots of different organ systems. The inflammatory process that hurts the lungs eventually gets disseminated into a systemic or system-wide inflammatory process, and the kidneys will shut down, the gut will shut down, the liver will shut down, etc. And so we support those organ systems as long as we can until hopefully the patient themselves recovers.
Yeah. Is there the danger of permanent lung damage?
There is the danger of permanent lung damage. We don't know yet. It's too early to know for sure. But what we do know is that for some of the cases that have presented, there has been an inordinate amount of tissue destruction in the lung, and that tissue destruction is permanent. Now, what the clinical impact of that permanent tissue destruction will be remains to be seen.
Greg in New Jersey is on the line now. Welcome to Radio Times, Greg.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Doctor, quick question. My stepson is 28 years old. He was vaping heavily when it first came out. He was diagnosed with sarcoidosis and of the lungs, and he's concerned that this sarcoidosis was triggered by this vaping, and potentially the sarcoidosis, what he's researched, can travel to other organs. Have you seen sarcoidosis present in any of your patients? Do you have any experience with that disease?
Thanks, Greg, for the call. What is sarcoidosis?
So sarcoidosis is a chronic inflammatory condition. It most frequently affects the lungs, but as Greg correctly pointed out, it can actually affect any organ system in the body. It produces a very specific kind of inflammation that's chronic and long-term. For most patients, Greg, their sarcoidosis gets under pretty good control and then stops progressing at that, you know, after it's been controlled. There are no reports yet of vaping or using e-cigarettes as causing sarcoidosis specifically. But
what is your sense as a pulmonologist, though?
So I think, as we talked about earlier, I think there's a lot of variables that go into this, mm-hmm. and so depending on the heat, the pH, the concentration or density of the aerosol, the chemical constituents, it has the ability to activate all kinds of different inflammatory pathways. And it's not impossible that the inflammatory pathway that's responsible for sarcoidosis is getting activated.
All right. Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Greg. Comment from Emily. My daughter smokes Juuls and thinks they're safe, but I'm worried because she's definitely addicted. How long does someone have to vape to experience dangerous long-term effects?
That's a great question, Emily. Nobody knows for sure. I would say that depending, there's a variety of presentations, and some of those presentations appear to be what we refer to as acute. Vape once or twice and actually end up with those manifestations. We just recently published a study at the University of Pennsylvania where we evaluated the impact on blood vessel constriction of first-time vapers. These were young people who were healthy, had never smoked cigarettes or used electronic cigarettes. And inhalation of 8 or 10 puffs off of an electronic cigarette caused an identifiable change in vascular reactivity.
And we're talking about any type of fluid, not just that which might contain marijuana products or nicotine products.
This particular study did not involve marijuana products at all.
Okay.
It was the same electronic cigarette that was used for all the subjects in the study. I would say to Emily that I don't think you need to think about this as a chronic or long-term cumulative problem. You should probably talk to your daughter about the effects, talk to her about the nature of addiction, and talk to her about the potential for getting treatment or help with that addiction.
Comment from Clay, what we're learning about vaping doesn't seem any different from when our parents learned about the dangers of cigarettes. Every generation has their thing.
I'd say that's pretty accurate. The difference is that with the speed of communication now, when our parents learned about lung cancer, there was a sort of slower cumulative effect. The industry was less well regulated at the time, and they were pretty good at injecting a lot of uncertainty at that time about the nature of lung cancer and heart disease. Here, we're now in 2019, we're communicating with each other faster, and we're getting up to the minute updates on how the syndrome is sort of evolving.
There's a little bit more urgency.
There's a little bit more urgency at this point, yeah.
Ari says, I used to be a heavy smoker, but since switching to vaping, I've completely quit smoking, and I know many people who have. I get annoyed when I hear vaping gets a bad reputation because it really helped me. So another perhaps plug for keeping e-cigarettes as an alternative. But again, earlier, Frank, we talked about the research just isn't there.
So,
in terms of if it's absolute.
Yeah, that's true. So I'm of two minds on this, and I'll make two important points. The first is that there's absolutely no denying that on an individual basis, we can certainly find individuals like the caller who have benefit from this. But on a large-scale population basis, the evidence is that electronic cigarettes can help people stop smoking in general, like reliably in a population, is actually very weak. And so while I'm happy for individuals who have seen benefit, I'm nervous about that, the idea of trying to extend that benefit to the whole population. It may not be the same thing. The second point that I'll make is that if you find and replace in your mind the idea of obsessive compulsive disorder, and someone has a compulsion to wash their hands, and what you've done is help them not wash their hands, but now their compulsion is to count objects on the kitchen table. Have you really helped them, right? And so in a lot of ways, taking the compulsive disorder of cigarette smoking and then substituting the compulsive disorder of using electronic cigarettes really is just substituting one type, one flavor, one manifestation of the underlying compulsion for another. My philosophy, our philosophy at Penn is our job is to treat the compulsion and then watch the behavior change disappear from there.
Yeah. So one final thought, vaping in any form,
right,
at this point.
My advice is don't do it.
All right. Frank Leone, great to have you with us for Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Mary. Thank
Frank you. Leone is Director of Comprehensive Smoking Treatment Programs at the University of Pennsylvania. And as always, you can find us here at Radio Times on social media. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.